We have, I believe, two or three, and that's what I've been told the maximum is, two or three. So I believe it'll be, let me see, Mr. Kefouri, Marshall, and Mr. Kramer. And I've been told that you can keep your comments all to within about 5 minutes. Start wherever you want to start.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Stephen Kefouri. I'm here representing Insight Schools. We are a virtual online high school. We are not a charter school. We are an alternative school. And I wanted to comment on two things. First of all, during the debate on the bill during the last session, let's face it, there were two groups. One, people wanted to have virtual charter schools. The people did not want to have virtual charter schools. And the people who did not want charter schools wrote as many amendments to 667 as they could to put impediments in the way of making charter schools work. We suggested that one solution would be to put a deadline on the timeout, put a sunset on the timeout. Because if you don't have a sunset on the timeout, there's no impetus for those who don't want charter schools to ever talk to the people who want charter schools. And we were told, don't worry about it, we're going to have a February session, everything will be taken care of. Well, just as we predicted, everything has not been taken care of. The can has been kicked further down the road because there is no deadline. And I suggest you might want to think about doing this in your bill. There's no deadline here. If the 2011 session does not come up with a conclusion, what happens? There's no impetus for those folks who don't want charter schools to try and come up with a workable solution. All the pressure is on for them to stall and put more roadblocks in the way of what you want to have done. So I would suggest, unless this bill has a sunset, it says unless at a certain time, unless the legislature agrees to something, then the 50% rule goes away, you're not going to ever have the 50% rule go away. And if you look at what one of the principles that you want to have on page 8 ensures that there's competition among providers, there's one way to get competition among providers. Right now you have virtually two providers. The only way to get competition is to open this up is to eliminate the cap and the 50% rule. If you do that, you will have competition. If you don't do that, you won't have competition. This bill, as it's presently written, maintains these two schools, and that's not competition.
Mr. Kramer.
Co-Chair Devlin, Co-Chair Gelser, members of the task force, my name is Rob Kramer. I represent Connections Academy. I just have a few points I want to make about this draft and kind of the general situation we find ourselves in. First of all, we do appreciate the fact that this committee and the legislature in 2009 did come to the decision that it did not want to be in the business of shutting down any virtual charter schools, despite the form of the first bill, 767. And we really do appreciate that, and we think that's heartfelt. However, I'd like to point out that there are thousands of students who would like to access virtual charter schools, and denying those children access to a virtual charter school that they're not able to enroll in now because of the caps put on in Senate Bill 767 is pretty much the same thing as shutting down a school for a child that is currently in a virtual charter school. So I'd ask you just to think about the thousands of kids who have expressed interest and a desire to enroll in a virtual environment right now, and to not distinguish between those kids and the kids who are in one, because it's a denying opportunity nevertheless. When I look at this bill, I look ahead and think, okay, well, what if it looks like in this bill that it's contemplated that the State Board of Education will come up with a governance model and answer these questions about what the best way to govern virtual charter schools are to ensure competition and to keep parental choice. And then that report will go to the 2011 session and presumably be cooked up into a bill and then gone through the 2011 session. What if nothing comes out of the 2011 session as far as putting that report into law? What then? Because what happens then, as far as I can tell, then the caps stay on. We're right back to the State Board of Education looking for a waiver from the 50% provision, which stays on. And the time frame to get that waiver in 2011 from the State Board will be from the end of the 2011 session to September 1, 2011. a very compressed time frame could be as 60 days to 90 days. Well, when Connections Academy got its waiver from the State Board, it took 9 months. And when Orva got its waiver from the State Board of Education, it took 10 months. So I would say, what happens if that report coming from the State Board of Education does not successfully get put into law, and those questions aren't answered? Can we deal with that on the front end through some type of a preemptive provision that says there's some status quo that will be maintained in the event that doesn't happen? And that is what I would like to point out.
Good morning, Chair Devlin and Co-Chair Gelser. My name is Marshall Kova. This morning, representing K-12 Incorporated and the Oregon Virtual Academy. Just a little brief background here. We've been involved with this for the last 4 years in Oregon, and began after the 2005 session. And the 2005 session was where, I believe it was Senate Bill 1071, created the 50% rule, and we began looking for an opportunity in Oregon Partner School in the fall of 2005. So all that we've known from a company's perspective are the barriers and the limitations and the restrictions and the caps and the struggle to adequately and fairly have a discussion about this issue. So I appreciate the task force. I appreciate, you know, the Senate Bill 767 discussion, but a lot of that struggle continues. We chose to seek a waiver from the 50% rule with the State Board of Education in the fall of 2007. And as Mr. Kramer pointed out, it took us about 10 months, and that was granted in June of 2008. So we had about a 60-day run-up until school started in September. We worked well with the State Board and thought there was a relatively open process. But it's interesting to me as we look at this and what's the LC-15 is talking about is sending back, I think, one of the major lifts, the heavy lifting of really this discussion, which is the governance discussion, back to the State Board. It's kind of deja vu all over again in that many or some who opposed our waiver and other waivers that were before the State Board at that time were suggesting that the State Board was not the appropriate forum to have that discussion, that it should come over to the legislature. The legislature, we were able to get our waiver and appreciate that. But so we come to the 2009 session. We have Senate Bill 767, which creates the 17-member task force, which is now pushing some things back to the State Board. And I guess my hope and my ask here is that those of us that are involved in this discussion, all of us in this room, we allow the State Board to act in the best interests of Oregon students and parents and to develop a plan that they can bring back here in 2011. We continue and pledge to work with the committee and the State Board to develop, I think, you know, the latest and the best program in America. I know that we have had testimony from Susan Patrick, I think the lead testifier, who made the point, I think very succinctly, that the world is embracing online education. And we have done nothing here except for, if we didn't get our waiver from the State Board and some people were entrepreneurial with the 50% rule and working district by district, you know, there's some significant limitations on what's going on in Oregon right now. I think Susan Patrick, and I know the co-chairs had a telephone conversation with John Watson, who is seen as one of the national leaders and puts out the Keeping Pace Report, which is a discussion of what's going on in the world of online education. I don't think it's that difficult, and I testified to that during the session. I think if we had like-minded people in the room, we could come up with this in a half a day to develop the system that would work well in Oregon. And I think John Watson's point is, if you have accountability on the front side and quality on the front side and accountability on the back side, is it a charter school? Is it state-run? Or not state-run, but is it state-authorized? These options are working well in the various states. So we look forward to working with this committee to finish up and with the State Board, and we're hopeful that the end product will allow students access and remove the caps, and that Oregon will embrace this option, as are so many other states and countries around the world. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I will attempt to actually respond to some of the questions there. First of all, we know that the issue of the 50% cap is an issue that's out there. Representative Gelser and I have been challenged in this process to develop a bill that could actually pass in February. And we know that that issue is going to be an item of further discussion and probably will come up in the discussion of governance. We also know that the discussion of governance models is probably not something we could resolve in the limited number of meetings that this task force has left. On your subject about what happens if nothing happens, Representative Gelser and I discovered about, I don't know what it was, a week, 10 days ago, that the way the current statute reads, at least the interpretation that we're hearing of it, I'm not an attorney, I haven't asked for a formal opinion on it, is that the Department of Ed could not act on an application for the school year 2011 to 11-12 until July 1st of 2011, the way the current statute reads. That's why we've attempted to put the provisions in this so that the Department of Ed could start down that process. I appreciate your comments that that process is sometimes relatively lengthy, and I think we have to probably take a closer look at that. But the intent of the bill that was passed by the legislature and the intent of what we're trying to do is not to close down any virtual charter school. So we have looked at that provision. I think as we go through the committee comments here, and we'll do that just in a few minutes, I'm hoping we can present literally the challenge that's been put to this task force. In the sense that there were things that we have chosen to deal with and things that we have chosen not to deal with. Maybe I could actually do that as the beginning of this. When we were established and people were appointed, we were given a certain charge. That way I don't have to repeat this. We were given a certain charge, a number of items to address. In a very limited number of meetings, the committee has went through those items. They've decided to put some of those off to the side and say basically that those items, they just don't think were that well thought out when they were put into the bill, i.e. we don't have enough information on which kids at which grade level should be in virtual charter school programs. So we don't think that the Department of Ed is going to actually be able to shed any light on that anytime in the near future because there's just not enough work done out there on that. Then we decided on what issues the task force itself could address, and then we decided on which issues that we would put back to the Board of Education or, in one case, put back to the legislature in terms of the issues around splitting the statute. And in essence, too, on the governance model, because we heard some concerns about the process from all sides at the Board of Education about how things are brought forward, we're actually requiring the Board of Education to come back to the legislature with a proposal, and the legislature will make a recommendation or will make a decision on that proposal in 2011. However, just to address an issue that I can see in your eyes, if that governance model doesn't change, that means you will basically have the status quo that come July 1st, 2011, the board, even though the 50% requirement will still be there, will then be able to grant waivers subject to whatever conditions the board thinks that they have the authority or they believe should be within those waivers. That's the status that you would be in 2011. You would still be under a waiver system, but there would be no prohibition on them granting waivers. And there's nothing in this statute that says, remember that in this LC there is a proposal that some of these requirements not be waiverable. There is nothing in this LC that says that the 50% requirement cannot be waived. So, I mean, I think that's a decision of what we put forward, too. So I hope that answers some of your questions.
Well, Co-Chair Devlin, it does, and we appreciate that you did have that provision in this LC draft to, you know, allow the waiver to be applied for prior to July 1, 2011, and that is significant. However, we still put in the scenario that you just proposed, we still have thousands of parents who literally will not know in July of the year prior to 2011-12 school year whether their school is going to be open that year because it'd be contingent upon a state board waiver. And once again, we heard from the parents today. That's one of the things that creates a tremendous amount of stress on these parents, not knowing if the school is going to be open the following fall. Every single year, pretty much, they have been in this situation. And at some point, you know, we've heard from them. And I think it's unfair to have these parents in that situation, again, almost by design of this draft.
May I ask a clarifying question? How would that language be more clear? I think the intent that we had in describing that was that under the law, the waiver itself could not be effective until July 1st of that year. Mm-hmm. But my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, Senator Devlin, is that the process could be gone through prior to July 1st. The State Board of Ed could vote, they could determine, they could decide to grant that waiver in advance of July 1st. So the families would tend to know prior to that July 1st. It's just the effective date of that waiver wouldn't be until July 1st. But you might have pre-knowledge months ahead of time that there would be a waiver that was going into effect on July 1st.
Co-Chair Devlin, Co-Chair Gelser, perhaps, and here's where it gets a little bit complicated. When the State Board is looking at a waiver, it needs to know exactly what provisions of the law they're waiving for the charter school. And the 50% provision, of course, is the big one that we've always been applying for waivers. But there have been other elements of the current law that have to be waived. Now, we're not going to know what those elements are because the governance model will be being discussed in the 2011 session. And it certainly is could be that there are all sorts of issues of governance that are decided in 2011 that the State Board won't know if it has to waive something in there or not. So you apply for a waiver. The State Board, during the session, is likely to say, well, we don't know what that's going to look like, so we can't discuss a waiver when we don't know what it is we might need to waive the school from. And that's precisely what happened in the 2009 session, as ORCA had its waiver request in, and the State Board kept delaying a decision on that waiver until the end of the 2009 session. So the fact of the matter is you really don't know what you're going to be waiving from, and that probably will freeze in place any decision on that waiver till after the session.
Mr. Chair, I've been around this building for a long time, and I've seen that when contentious issues come before the legislature, the most effective way to get those contentious issues resolved is to force the two groups, the opposing parties, to put them in the same room and have them come up with a compromise. That can only occur if both sides see they have something to lose. If one side has nothing to lose, there's no impetus for them to come into that room and talk. And right now, there's the people who don't want charter schools or don't want virtual schools to happen have no reason to present any suggestions, to do any compromises, to do any discussion. The way to make that happen is to say that the 2011 session is going to come up with something. And if it doesn't come up with something, then the 50% rule is waived. If you put that on this bill, I promise you, you will have an agreement by the time the 2011 session starts that has all parties holding hands on a governance.
Okay. Mr. Kapoor, you're an optimist. Our difficulty is to get a statute passed in February so that we can address the issue that you've just brought up. The more that we create controversy in February, I think what we're trying to do is do this in steps so that, and I fully understand Mr. Kramer's concern that because of, if you're going to have this governance discussion, perhaps something can change that could affect the waiver. But there has been a fair amount of discussion about the 50% rule, about whether or not it is the best method to address this issue. But it hasn't been simply a discussion of throwing out the 50% rule entirely, because there's also been a discussion, fairly open discussion, about how bricks and mortar charter schools do not present the same challenges that virtual charter schools do. For instance, for a district like my colleague over there, Mr. Glaze, for a Beaverton to lose 50 students is not a particularly a big matter. For some school districts to lose 50 students is a significant issue.
For the bricks and mortar side.
For the bricks and mortar side. But I'm responsible, the members on this task force that have been charged and the members of the legislature are responsible for seeing for every child. Not, you can't, just throwing out the 50% is not an uncontroversial issue to put before the legislature.
I'm not suggesting that you do that, Mr. Chair. What I'm saying is that the suggestion is you put a time limit on. That unless an agreement is reached, the 50% rule is repealed. If you do that, what you do is force negotiations, which right now have not happened. During the session, we were told there's going to be a short timeout. Don't worry about it. I said, I worry about it a lot. If you put a deadline, say, in March, of 2010, the 50% rule is going to be repealed, then I know you're going to have something happen in February of 2010. But I said, if you don't put a deadline on, I will promise you nothing happens in February 2010. I think that's what's going to happen right now. And I think the same thing will happen in 2011. Unless you put a deadline, you're never going to have it.
So, and I'm speaking only for myself. I don't want to end up with mud thrown on my good colleague over here. I think that what will happen in February are the things that we can accomplish, which includes that safeguard that allows you to get a waiver so that the schools can open the following year. So, I think that that is, to be really frank, a stake that you have in this to want to see the bill pass in February. I think if we were to, well, yes, sorry, Mr. Foy, I believe... I thought we were all kumbaya. We're all in this together, right? I think the challenge is if we put in anything related to the 50% rule, whether it is after the timeline the 50% rule expires or you reach the deadline and no more waivers to the 50% rule, the controversy that's associated with that will bog down a bill such that it will not pass in February. It's a 3-week session where you have to have pretty broad agreement moving forward, and you lose all of the other pieces. And I disagree, and it may be that I'm not understanding correctly. I disagree that there's no incentive, and I understand that you're in a different place because you're structured differently and you're not part of these two pieces, but the consequence for those who would like to see more restriction on the 50% rule is that if there's no action in 2011, it goes back to what it was before, and there's no limit on the way that waivers can be granted in relation to the 50% rule. So, I think there's still that hook and a relative degree of uncertainty and unsettlement among everyone that's involved in this. I think we all crave a solution. I'm just not as confident that... I liked the phrase, if you can get like-minded people in a room, we can hammer out an agreement in a couple of hours. I agree. We just have a lack of like-minded people. We have a lot of people that look at this in a lot of different ways.
Okay. Anything additional? Thank you very much.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you.
Okay. What we're going to do now in approximately about 45 minutes, so I can get you out about 5 minutes before, we're going to go through and get comments from each one of the task force on the draft itself. And I'm going to reiterate this again just so that people have a clear understanding of this. The task force had a specific charge about more than a dozen different areas. The task force went through those areas, decided to actually lay some of them to the side, but that they thought probably, I shouldn't use the term not well thought out, but just that they just don't believe that there's something the task force can deal with right now or should deal with right now. They don't believe it should necessarily be a priority for the Board of Education right now, and those items were set aside. Then there was a decision that some items should be sent back to the Board of Education for them to address. I mean, some of those items, we've talked a lot about the governance model, but there is the open issue just about trying to determine how in sort of these new environments we can deal with issues around special needs children. That's just sort of a broad thing. And then because we got a report back on how various schools are funded, including public virtual charter schools, the committee basically, I think, said that the information is inconclusive and that the department should continue to study that issue. Then we came to the items that the committee was going to act on, which are actually within this, and then I'm not being as clear today, I'm just actually getting over a cold too. And what's in the draft is those items that the committee was going to act upon, and those items that we were going to transfer on to others to act upon in the future or to make recommendations to the legislature in the future. So what we're trying to do is get specific comments about the draft itself, because we are in a very limited time frame. And in speaking about that limited time frame to try to provide some clarity, you're all being queried about a meeting date. That meeting date, I believe now, is probably going to be November 30th. So we have to conclude our work by that time. But that does not conclude the work on this legislation. That means that is only the draft that is being submitted to Legislative Council, and that draft will come back out as a bill during the February session, and I believe will probably be discussed by the Education Committees in concept even before the February session. And there will be plenty of time for public comment during that process, and the bill will be considered at that time. So it's not really final when we send it forward. We're just sending our best recommendation forward. So given that, I'm going to start off with Mr. Glaze over on the...
Okay. You want to just quickly close the public hearing?
Yes, I should have to close the public hearing.
Well, thank you, Senator Devlin. It's kind of a daunting task to be representative here for public schools, and obviously what we're hearing as input from the audience is fairly one-sided. Most of the people here are in favor of online charter schools, and I certainly don't want people to get the idea here in the audience that I, as one, am against public charter schools or online charter schools, because that's not the case. My belief, though, is that as we roll this thing out, we need to do so in a very deliberate, careful, planned manner. That's best for the state, that's best for students, that's best for education in general in Oregon. And so it's kind of a daunting task, knowing that most of the public educators that I work with are in the trenches and are not here and able to present their side of the conversation as they might be able to present that. And you're not able to hear that here today as a committee. And to try and put that and articulate that into words is not an easy thing. But what I'll try to do is address some of the things that have come up today as succinctly as I can. We talked quite a bit here about the 50% rule, and frankly, from my perspective, I think the legislators used a considerable amount of wisdom in putting that into place. Again, there are so many unanswered questions with regards to online education from a state perspective that I think there was wisdom in slowing this thing down and trying to do it right. Accountability issues around finance are big. Special education issues and how we address those are significant. The quality of the education that's presented and how it's presented and the contacts and the issues that play out there are all very big issues, and probably biggest issue for me, and I've said this before, but is the whole issue of statute. You know, we're operating in an environment where our statute is an anachronism. Our statute addresses charter schools within a school district. And here we have online charter schools, we have charter school districts, we have things happening all over the state that are not guided by statute. And so the fact that we need to rewrite the statute is one of the biggest challenges we have before this committee. And I would concur with most of the statements that have taken place here today that I do believe it's wise to separate the two out. That we look at statute for charter schools and we look at statute for virtual charter schools and separate the two. I think that they're too different to be put into one hat and addressed together. So I would be a proponent for separating those two things out. And I read the letter that was brought here today to the meeting addressed to Senator Devlin, and it's from Timothy Colahan, I believe, and it's addressing some issues that have occurred in Harney County regarding financial issues. And again, this has been a concern of mine as we roll these online charter programs out. Are we doing it in a way that we can be accountable for financially? I don't know anything about the facts of this letter other than I find it very disturbing. I do hope that we are looking into the situation in Harney County from the perspective of the Oregon Department of Education. But I would think that these are the kind of issues that when the committee gets together and looks at appropriate levels and methods of funding, that these are the kind of things we're also studying to make sure that we are doing this in a way that we're not opening up a can of worms to create even more problems for us on a statewide basis when it comes to funding. I think that's probably my comments.
Ms. Hunt.
Thank you. I submitted to the entire task force comments about Senate Bill 767. This was prior to seeing LC 15. So I'm not going to rehash a lot of these comments that are in writing here. There's a couple, though, that I think are significant, but I also have specific comments on LC 15. So the comments that I submitted in writing were based on after the passage of 767, we got together a big work group and we're trying to do rules. And so a lot of these comments were gleaned from stakeholder group meetings and just questions and comments we've gotten from the field. So generally at the department, we want the law to be clear. And we believe that that way the schools will know, you know, what set of standards they're under, and the districts will know what they're supposed to be holding them accountable to. But some of the biggest comments that I put in writing was, I want to draw your attention to the equity piece, because I know that multiple staff members have raised that as an issue. And right now, in paragraph H, which in LC 15 is on page 3, paragraphs H and I are attempting to address, I think, equity in these schools, but they do it in a way that does not get there. And I think it's because of the structure of kind of those two paragraphs. And so I'll give you an example. Under these two paragraphs right now, a virtual charter school could meet this requirement by just providing a computer and printer equipment to students and not internet access or other equipment that they might need or technology. So it's kind of a very narrow way of attempting to address equity. And when we met with stakeholders, this was something that a lot of the stakeholders were kind of scratching their heads over, because they also commented that a lot of schools are addressing equity in a number of ways. I mean, by inviting kids to come to classrooms or to come to public spaces, by providing technology, all of that. And so in my comments, I laid out one suggestion as far as how to amend H&I to address equity, which is to direct the schools to provide free of charge computer equipment, printing equipment, internet services, etc., that are necessary for the student to participate in the regular school program. And regular school program is something that is defined by law. It's basically kind of during the day. It's the core classes. So that was, I think, one of the pieces in the comments that I wanted to highlight because of so many task force members mentioning equity. Specifically on LC 15, we had some concerns when we saw this, and I want to draw your attention to paragraph F, which is on page 2, is I'm sure this wasn't the intent, but the language here, I believe, literally says that the school may only employ superintendents, assistants, and principals, and teachers, and it doesn't necessarily allow them to employ other types of personnel. So I would encourage a fix on that, because we know virtual schools employ probably other personnel. And...
Good job,
Laddie. And... The other thing that I saw here is that this limitation was only directed at the employees employed by the school, but in the world of charter schools, employees can be employed by a sponsor, a school district as well. And so this also has a kind of a loophole. But so those were a couple of comments I wanted to make on that section that I thought needed to be kind of shored up. And then on page 4 in the new section, and I think it's paragraph not N, on line 7. This is the section that where the students are or the schools are sending information back and forth between the resident district and the school. And the particular line, it says the name of the school in which the student will enroll. This is information that the charter school must send to the resident school district. I believe that some of these schools won't know this information.
Yeah, I heard that too.
Because as students drop out, they don't necessarily tell their schools where they're going. And some students will also go to homeschooling, for example, and just not have a school. Mm-hmm. So what I'm suggesting is that that's an if known is added, like the name of the school in which the student will enroll, if it's known by the charter school. And I'll look to some of my colleagues in the task force. I'm seeing a nod of the head from Larry Glaze that sometimes the schools just don't know where their students go after they drop out. And then in subsection 3 on the same page, there was this subsection's requiring that these virtual charter schools provide access to all the documents that are in subsections 1 and 2. And then it says, except for documents with personally identifiable information. The concern I have about that is that personally identifiable information could be the name of a person, for example, the name of a person on a contract or an agreement. Or it could be, and for example, the salaries of management personnel, often sponsors ask for that kind of information. They want to know specifically what the management personnel, who's getting paid what, because they're looking at the financial viability of the school. So my suggestion with this is that while we also don't want information being given out about specific students and that kind of thing, is that we make this consistent with public records laws and say except for documents that are exempt from disclosure under public records laws. And what that does is that student records that are exempt because of FERPA and so forth would still be included. Those would be the primary things that would be exempt under this, but then there's another list. But those public records laws are laws that apply to virtual charter schools now, so they'll know those standards as well. Mm-hmm. And then, finally, I'd just like to reiterate the comments of my colleague Morgan Allen on the final section, the study. And I think, you know, I appreciate a lot of the comments around clarifying this section. And I think I heard that, you know, the priority is the governance model versus the other two sections. And that would be, you know, welcome as we're setting priorities and addressing how to assist the state board in its work should they be charged with doing this. So that concludes what I have to say.
Mark?
Thank you, Co-Chairs Devlin and Gelser and the rest of the task force members. Just as an introduction, again, I'm a board member of the Virtual Academy, and education and legislation is not my day job. So when I say things, I don't mean to presume on your areas of expertise, and a lot of people have been very helpful in informing me on questions I've had so far. So if I say something that's like blindingly uninformed, I want to beg your indulgence ahead of time. Going through the draft of LC 15 and I guess even before that, the concepts that we have of breaking apart the legislation for virtual schools and charter schools, it seemed to be a good idea that everyone is supportive of. I would say on page 2 of the LC, when we're talking in lines 10 through 12 about significantly involving parents and guardians of students enrolled in the school, it seems like something that you couldn't help but support, but it also sounds like it's not necessarily something that's also being done at the traditional schools or the brick-and-mortar charter schools. It's a great idea. I'm not sure how we're going to implement that, and it might be an extra burden on top of the virtual schools. It would certainly contribute to student success. I'm just not sure that that's something that really should be gone into at this point. Further down the page, where we're talking about employing, in addition to all our other employees, superintendents, assistant superintendents, principals, others, I like to say, getting back to the testimony where that's not necessarily something that a gives them additional skills in administering the school, that we take that into consideration. I know in, say, technical support, where you get someone with a Microsoft certified systems engineer, you can have someone take a weekend workshop course, get the certification, and you put them in front of a computer and all that knowledge goes out of their head and it's worthless. And someone would probably rather have someone who's been working with computers for years rather than a paper MCSE. If you do go this route, and we're looking at making this a requirement that existing administrators, employees be given some sort of time to complete this as well, so they're not just chopped off right off the block.
And this would apply only to virtual charter schools, not to charter schools.
Okay. So. Let's see. We had on page 3 Ms. Hunt's recommendation that the financial records be at the sponsoring district, which, you know, seems reasonable, because if you've got someone who's interested in getting the records, you would go to North Bend in our case and want to see them. And if we had ours way out in Ontario, that would probably be a burden on the public records access. A little further down the page, something to consider. When we're talking about providing computers, printers, and internet service cost reimbursements, our agency is providing computers and printers, and we do the reimbursements, but for someone who's low income, the idea that I'd have to outlay for the internet service and then wait, and, you know, it's probably not a very long period of time, but wait for that reimbursement check, that could be something, depending on your income level, that you decide not to go down that path strictly because of the family finances. So if there's a way to actually do a pre-reimbursement or set up a pool of funds that can then be, you know, gone out of for families that, you know, might not otherwise choose to go down this, you know, virtual school path. The student withdrawals and everything like that, the information that's going back to the schools seems good. Also on page 4, what, subsection N, we're talking about plans on how to handle. There's also times where we have students that we just can't contact, and there should be a plan on when you administratively decide that this student really isn't a part of my school and just through truancy we're going to have them disenrolled. I mean, I'm sure most schools probably have a situation like that. I know ours does, where the head of school just, you know, in conjunction with the teacher says this person hasn't been there, they're disenrolled, and we'll do that. But there should be something in there that specifies under these circumstances this student will be considered disenrolled, and then we'll provide the notification back to the home district. The waivers and the 50% rule, and a lot of these issues in here, they come up, you know, ORS 338.025, and then it doesn't actually have a appendix that tells me what 338.025 is, so Google's been a good friend so far. I had to go back to 338.125 and try and figure out what this was, and this might be where my, like, misinformed nature comes in. I was looking at this where North Bend was interested in bringing in K-12 because they really liked the academic program, and this is protecting North Bend, or at least that's my interpretation of it, where they say, we want you to come in and offer this to our students, and then if space is available, we'll offer it to other students as well. You wouldn't want an agency to come in and say, well, that's great, we're glad to be here, but I'm sorry, we've already given all our slots away to someone else. So I didn't see it so much as a 50% was, you know, good to protect, you know, other schools. It was good to protect that home district where we've created something that we're proud of and we want this to be available to our students. As it turns out, maybe not so many people in our home district as we thought are enrolling in this, and we've got a wide capacity to deliver this education to someone else, and we want to make that available, not to cap it down at, you know, 50 students, 100 students, 400 students, but that if we suddenly had an upsurge in enrollment of North Bend students, that we would make sure that spots were available for North Bend students to take them, not that we would just say, well, we're going to cut that limit preemptively. So that was my take on it. As a little side note on that, we've in addition to having our enrollment cap, we also, as part of our waiver process, agreed to not do high school. So even status quo, we're going to be not able to continue teaching our 9th, 10th, 12th graders. As they get out of the 8th grade, they have to go somewhere else, and they can't continue on with our program. So for the 6th grader that they were talking about earlier today, maybe something will be done in the next 2 years that takes care of them, but we have a crop of 8th graders from last year, this year, 7th graders this year, who are looking at where am I going to go for high school because I know that I can't go to, you know, Orva.
Mr. Lynn, and just noting on the time, I think I count about 10 people left, so we actually have about 3 minutes each.
My apologies.
Representing charter schools and all parents and teachers and students being served in this arena, I too have some questions pertaining to LC 15 in its draft form. And if you look at page 9, where it talks about a study of appropriate levels of funding for virtual public charter schools, and this probably would take effect later down the road, I guess I would ask this committee, is it the intention of the task force to draft a bill that affects all public charter schools? And if you look at line 2 and 3, there's made mention to other public charter schools that offer online instruction. And if not, do we need to revise or take out language that includes those other charter entities? They could be using online instruction for credit recovery purposes or to enrich a class that they're offering in a brick-and-mortar system. I also wrote down, do we as a task force need to define what it means for purchasing or contracting online services? And I say that because thinking of a traditional brick-and-mortar system, we contract and purchase textbooks to support teaching and learning in a regular classroom. And it's just a resource to have available for teachers. And if a public charter school is just contracting out curriculum, online curriculum, where they themselves have hired HQ teachers who are licensed by TSPC to manage those courses, is that considered contracting online services? And then, in effect, are they then subject to all the requirements that are placed in this bill, such as on page 4, where we are to have, or schools are supposed to have, records made available that talk about third-party finances, which would be the online curriculum sources, and information pertaining to salaries, benefits, and those kinds of things. And so those are just things I think that we'll need to look at as we move forward and gear up for our final meeting on the 30th.
Okay. Representative Dimbro.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. 3 minutes is going to be hard, but I'll just be...
Gettysburg address.
So I'll triage. Triage seems to be the message of this task force. I want to, first of all, thank the people who came and testified. I learned a lot today. I've heard a lot of testimony on this matter, and I thought I couldn't learn anything more, but I did today. It's given me things to think about. I mentioned the word triage. When I first signed on to this, Senate Bill 767, I had hopes that the task force would have the time and the resources to be able to, you know, really look at online education in this state in a fundamental, sort of comprehensive, forward-looking way. And I realized because of limitations, you know, we had to triage and, you know, we had to move some things over to the State Board of Education. And while I understand that, I find it somewhat frustrating. And I would certainly, value and would want to have serious input from the State Board of Ed. I think they're on track to really to do good work in this area. Having the recommendations from them or the results of their study going directly to the legislature in February of 2011. I'm just not sure. I have to really think through that sort of timeline. That That seems late to me, first of all, for any work to happen. I would, you know, appreciate, real, if we're going to do that, appreciate an earlier deadline. And I don't know if, Nikki, maybe you can say something about whether that's realistic for the State Board. I think that would be useful. You know, I think the LC is a little vague still, and we've talked about this, on what it's actually asking the State Board to do. You know, some parts are just, they're asking to study these issues as opposed to make recommendations, but I think, you know, we have expectations that they're going to make recommendations, and I think maybe we could be more explicit about that. I thought that Karen Heikes's comments about the hybrid and the sort of vagueness of the way we're talking about hybrid models, you know, was right on target. You know, it's not just a question of full-time versus part-time, you know, that kind of hybrid. But when we heard about the success of hybrid models, it was really models in which online instruction is integrated, you know, into the, you know, the face-to-face. And so, you know, I would like to hear from the State Board, you know, how online education in general and, you know, credit recovery, et cetera, you know, could be, could and should be funded and made more available, frankly, so that it's easier for schools to take advantage of that. I think I'll just leave it there. Thank you.
Okay. Ms. Blum, Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Senator Devlin. Thank you.
Or Senator Bonamici, I'm sorry.
Thank you. I thought you
I almost elevated you to the House.
I have fond memories of the House. I, like Representative Dembo, have learned a lot in this process, done a lot of extracurricular reading and visited, for example, Insight School and spent some time in the home of one of my constituents whose child is enrolled in online education. And when I heard Marshall say that he thought that we could put people together in a half a day and solve this, I thought, wow, if it only were so. But in fact, it's much more complex than that. And I've struggled with how we balance, as Senator Devlin said, representing all of the students in the state, not simply the 1-2% who are in online education. And that's where my struggle has been, because we need to look at how whatever is structured for online education is affecting existing districts. And as Senator Devlin also said, in districts like Beaverton or in Portland, which is primarily where my legislative district is, a couple of students here and there is not going to really change things. But in many districts, it certainly will. If they lose a certain number of students to online education, they're going to see an impact in their class sizes and in the course offerings. And how is what we're doing affecting other districts? And so that's been my struggle. Specifically on the LC15, there's some things that I think a lot of things have already been mentioned. I'm not comfortable with the plan language. Maybe that's my old dusty law degree, but when the requirement is to have a plan, it's not to do what we're saying you should do in the plan. So I'd like to fix that. If we're requiring something, let's require it, not just say that you have to put it in a plan. It's been mentioned, but the vague direction to the State Board and in the sections on page 8, I think need to be clarified to give that better direction. And I don't see any problem with having a firm timeline in there. I'm really glad I hadn't heard about the payment issue, but I had the same reaction I did when somebody told me that their child was offered money to retake the SAT after he'd been accepted into college, because then it would make the college scores look better for the U.S. News and World Report. And I had the same reaction when I heard the story about the payment. So that concerns me greatly. I'm glad that that's going to be addressed. The big picture issues of equity and access I still struggle with. I understand the comment about we don't require more parental involvement, significant parental involvement in brick-and-mortar charter schools or in public schools, but wow, what a difference that would make. And I know you have all heard me say many times I don't question that many of the students who are enrolled in online education are successful, but is their success attributable to being enrolled in online education, or is it attributable to the fact that they have a one-on-one personal teacher? So I'd heard at one point, this is another one of those rumors, that if there's a family who wants to enroll in an online charter school and they don't have a parent accessible, that the online charter school will find them a learning coach. That concerns me, because then where's the safety in that? Who do we know who we're sending in? Are we sending somebody into somebody's home? So we really need to look into that issue as well. And again, I don't know if that's a rumor, but it is an access issue. And to the people who are listening online, yes, I know that there are many people, because I got an email after I made this comment last time. I know there are many people who can change their work schedules to accommodate being learning coaches, even though they're working. But many people cannot. Single parents. Single parent households and that kind of thing. So we still have those issues to grapple with. I know we won't be doing that in February, but specifically to LC15, I've made my comment. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I recognize that. A lot of good comments. I'm not going to repeat those for sake of time, but I'm going to shoot down a few bullet points, and I will be brief. Regarding caps, I think from a business background and competitive situations, if school districts are meeting the needs of their students and parents, they're not going to have to worry about losing students out of their school system to virtual learning. There could be some exceptions, but I think by and large, if the school district is trying to meet the needs of the students and parents, they're not going to have to worry about losing students out and losing 50 students or whatever. I still have a problem with the TSPC certification of superintendents and assistant superintendents, because we've mentioned numerous times we're concerned about how much, virtual are for-profit businesses. That's been discussed a number of times, and there has been some concern. Others don't have a concern, but when we're dealing with a different model than we've traditionally dealt with in a brick and mortar, I'm not sure why we would separate out and require TSPC certification for superintendents and assistant superintendents. Principals, teachers, that's fine, I understand. But, we could be looking at a CEO of a business model, and I'm not sure where the benefit would be for them to be TSPC certified. On the teacher being licensed for Oregon, I'd like to see an exception in there somehow, because I can see some of the more specialized classes like Mandarin, where a school district's not going to have a Mandarin teacher, and maybe even the state of Oregon wouldn't have enough Mandarin teachers for ORCA or K-12 to employ a Mandarin teacher. But maybe there's a Mandarin teacher in New Jersey that's a part of the system, and an Oregon student could participate in that class. But would we require the New Jersey virtual teacher to be Oregon licensed to teach Mandarin? That just a concern. And another thing, Jerry Wilkes was talking about, they've done a pretty good job of getting special needs students into their program. And as the board addresses, special needs students and the funding mechanism there, I think it's incumbent upon us to make sure that if we're going to require virtual schools to provide and in fact try to get special needs students in as a part of their mix, I'd want to make sure that they're reimbursed at a proper level. The typical student ADM probably wouldn't be fair if they're having to address additional needs that the host school district isn't meeting, but the virtual is. So I think as far as reimbursement, we need to look and make sure that we're allowing the virtual model to get enough money to be profitable and do the job. That's it.
Please. Thank you. Thank you, Senator Devlin. I'd like to take this opportunity to thank those that have worked so hard on LC 15. I think you've addressed many of the concerns that certainly I had at coming into this task force and representing the Oregon Education Association, which I think many have painted as being an enemy in the room. And I want you to know that we're here to try and resolve differences and find workable solutions. From my perspective, one of the issues that got lost in some of the testimony today was the financial impact on districts. And so the concern around the caps, I think, is real for many of our districts. And the concern around funding in general in this state is huge. And I heard that from parents that testified, not only for our virtual charter schools and our public charter schools, but also for our schools in general. And as we're facing the future with not great hope for increased funding that at least I can see in the next February session or even the 2011 session, I think that has to be kept in mind as to how do we balance what's best for all students in the state of Oregon. We appreciate the addressing the issues around licensure. We do believe licensure is critical for our educators and also for our administrators who evaluate our educators. Perhaps a dual model is a possibility. I think there are some ways to look at this, but we appreciate the insertion of the licensure issues. And Senator Devlin, I believe you clarified that what you were looking for, I believe it's on page 8 around the information from the state board, is that they would bring back a recommendation to the legislature, not that you were expecting the state board to make these decisions. Did I hear you correctly on that, sir?
Yes. Okay. I think our clear understanding from our discussions here and from people that have approached us on all sides of this issue was that they wanted, in all deference to the state board, they wanted the recommendation that for governance to come back to the legislature, for the legislature to ultimately take action on it or not take action.
Thank you. Thank you for that clarification. I really hope that we can continue in those discussions, both with the state board and the legislature, to look at these hybrid models and multiple hybrid models, because I think that's where the most positive impact can come for helping schools and districts and individual students, is looking at how do we provide that continuum of support in education. I would have to agree with Senator Bonamici. I'm still worried about the issue of access. It's terrific when there is so much parental support available for students. That's not necessarily available to all students who might want to access the online schooling. So I still have some concerns around that. But I think we've made huge progress with this LC 15. And thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Ms. Squire, and before that, could I just please state, so that people are shaking their heads back there, there is the other issue, is that I doubt, given the complexity of these statutes and how much has already been defined, about whether the state board could actually put in a new governance model without statutory authority.
Yeah.
So.
Good point.
Yeah.
Thank you, Chair Devlin. I have just four comments related specifically to LC 15. And some other things that others have said, so I will not repeat points that have been made. On page 2, lines 14 through 18, related to the budget and accounting system of the school must be compatible. There's a line in there that troubles me, and it is on line 16, to the extent practicable. That is another one of those phrases that I think provides a loophole. I can't think of a situation where an entity using public funds should not be held to the public accounting rules. So I'd ask us to consider whether we want that kind of fuzziness in the financial requirements. Also, on page 8, this relates to, of course, the assignment that is being given to the state board. it seems to me that I have heard an agreement from this committee, and I know it was the unanimous position of the State Board when we were working on our position paper, that unpackaging the charter school law and the virtual education laws made sense. So to that end, I would suggest that we consider deleting the word charter under Section 6, Sub A, Line 22. I think if we were asked to develop for the legislature's consideration a governance model for virtual public schools, that would free the board to separate those two things. The way this is written, it sounds to me as if they have to be kept together. So if that could be done, I think it would help us with our assignment. Throughout the document, I really would agree with Senator Bonamici that we need to replace the requests for a plan to do this and a plan to do that to the language that is in most of the statutes, that an entity shall do something or may do something, and we decide what we want to make mandatory and what we want to make optional and make that clear. My final comment is also on page 8, line 28. This is the sub C under the governance model, and this is a question, and I think it's one that is really important for us, all of us. This says that part of that governance model needs to protect the student's ability to choose the school at which the student will enroll. And I would submit that students do not have currently in Oregon or in the United States the ability to choose the school at which they will enroll at public expense. Given unlimited resources, probably all of us would advocate for that. But the way this is written, you know, if that were the case, some students would be going to $25,000 a year private schools at public expense, and other students would. So I think we need to really clarify what the intent is here. I think I understand what the intent is in keeping with current charter school laws, choice among public options, but I think this potentially could be very troublesome language. So I'd ask us to rethink how that is phrased. Then just one other final comment. So much of what has troubled us and troubled the board when we were doing our work are allegations and reports of what are probably exceptions but are truly financial irregularities, paying people to enroll, encouraging school districts to misrepresent counts, those kinds of things. We have a letter to that effect to which one of our other committee members referred today. I think we need to keep in mind as we do all of this that, you know, an entrepreneurial system has its pluses and its minuses. All kinds of good experimentation and improvements can occur, but it also opens the door, you know, for a few people to line their pockets. And so I think we do really need to focus on this accounting responsibility and make sure that we're very clear about the oversight that will take place there. I think that's all I have, sir. Okay.
Next. Yes, Ms. Reagan.
Great. When I was on break, one of the folks who testified said that we were doing a good job of looking interested, all of us up here, and that was intended to be a compliment, and it was just such a funny comment because I think we're all here because we realize that in Oregon we're kind of behind the ball in terms of how we're dealing with online education, and it's not a matter of looking interested. We actually are interested. I share Representative Dembrow's concerns that while I think that LC15 is a great start, when I agreed to serve on this task force as a school board representative, I thought it would be a much broader discussion about online learning in Oregon, not just how we do online charter school learning in Oregon. And I guess I'm still trying to figure out how we get to the idea of how do we provide online learning opportunities for every student throughout Oregon. I know we have some limitations. In terms of Lori Satinspiel's testimony, I wanted to mention that at the OSBA conference this past weekend, the two things that came up over and over again from school board members when we talked about, when we had workshops on charter schools and on online learning, the two issues that came up over and over again was the whole idea of districts becoming charter districts and online learning. I mean, over and over again. And but in terms of the online learning portion, which is what we're here to talk about, I didn't hear testimony and comments from board members around Oregon saying we don't want online schools, that we don't want online charter schools. Instead, it was we recognize that online learning is an important option for our students, and we have to figure out how to make it accessible across the board to every student in Oregon, whether that's classes or schools or however it's going to be. So then just general things. In terms of LC15, I think in general, I'm happy to see some teacher licensure guidelines in there. I think notification related to student status, if they're enrolling or disenrolling, is really important so that we are always looking out for the interests of the student and what's happening to that student and who's kind of capturing the student and helping them along. I think in terms of determining the governance model, that's absolutely critical, this whole issue of whether our charter schools, if that's the way online is provided, are full-time access or part-time access, I think we really need to take a look at the special ed issues, the appropriate funding issues. All of those are really important. I guess, so I'm actually pretty pleased with what I'm seeing in this draft, but again, it's a pretty narrow focus, and the reason I asked the question at the beginning about what is this compared to what's the work of the committee, this to me seems like one piece, and I'm hoping that the committee does come out with a report that is more, that is stronger and has more of our sense as a committee that, I mean, a couple of things that we've heard is that, you know, we need to separate online learning from the charter school law, and I think there seems to be general consensus around that, and while I agree that maybe it can't be in here, I think it needs to be in a report that comes out. And the other thing I would say is that we maybe as a group ought to be encouraging someone to do a 10-year review of our charter school law in general, because again, when we're hearing from board members, 900 board members this weekend, districts becoming charter school districts and online learning were just not envisioned back in 1999 when the law went into effect, and it's just good public policy when you pass a pretty sweeping piece of legislation to go back and take a look at some of the unintended consequences. Some things are working brilliantly in terms of our charter school law that we passed, and other things aren't, but more importantly, we have some unintended consequences, and we ought to all be talking about what those are. So thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Regan. We have two people maybe on the phone. Ms. Scalise, are you there?
Yes, I am.
If you could comment briefly.
Well, yeah, I'm listening and following the comments here. There's a lot that everyone's discussed. I don't know that I have a lot to add at this time.
Okay. Well, I very much appreciate, and I think everyone appreciates you being sitting in on the committee today. Let's see, who else is on the phone?
Dennis Dempsey.
Mr. Dempsey? Mr. Dempsey, are you there?
Yes, sir. Can you hear me?
Yeah. If you just speak up, I can hear you, but I'm only about a foot and a half from the speaker, so you maybe need to speak up a little bit louder.
Can you hear me better now?
Yeah.
Okay, real quick, thanks for letting me be involved. I've been out with the flu for a few days. Well, first off, the committee needs to know that it's obviously an expectation outside this room that this committee is going to solve all the problems in virtual education. That's obviously not going to happen today, but LC15 is a good start, but from my perspective, it's not bold enough yet. There is, as I heard from several folks there, a high-level concern from K-12 school district superintendents. They need clarity, and they really do want to see, generally, there's a consensus of separation, as we've said, of virtual education from charter school law. OAE has asked me to present the proposal I gave the committee about a possible solution. We really do need to look for a solution. I've always been supportive of multiple sources of virtual ed for all the kids in the state. We have to address the equity issues, but I can't believe, I think we're getting to the point now that maybe we're going to have to look at all the millions of dollars that are being spent on virtual ed already in this state, and maybe, I can't believe I'm saying this, that maybe we do need to look more realistically at the Florida model. And by the way, the Center for Digital Ed just came out and ranked the states again for online education, and it's hard to believe Oregon comes in number 9 and Florida number 1. What does that, all that says to me is, what does that mean for the rest of the nation? Because if we're facing these challenges, imagine what's going on in the rest of the country. But I really have to encourage this group to take some bold steps, because at least the K-12 superintendents in the state are looking for some leadership and clarity on this issue. And a great job and great comments by everybody.
Okay. Chair Gallison.
I can defer comment until later, okay, except for to say thank you to everyone that took the time to come and testify today, and for the thoughts from the committee. It's very helpful.
We're going to take the comments by everyone that we've received today. Chair Gelser and I are going to be meeting fairly soon again, and meeting again. I just asked Dana Richardson if she had a few hours off for Thanksgiving, if that was planned. but there's a lot of clarity that needs to be provided. I find it interesting. Chair Gelser and I think are in the same position. Basically, when we speak in this room into the audience, everything that we say, we would be better off just being quiet, because every time we try to provide clarity, we upset someone in the room. I'm going to try to do that in one regard. I've talked about Section 6. I'm going to upset people, and then I'm going to upset other people, so everybody's going to remain upset. We do think that the governance model should be broader than virtual charter schools. But the governance model has to include charter schools. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, there is not a choice out there, and that's probably the basic purpose for charter schools to exist. I think we're just looking to give an open door to the Board of Education, because they are the people that have had to deal with this on more of a month-to-month basis than actually the legislature. They have had more exposure to some of these issues than we have had to come back and make a recommendation to the legislature on a governance model. I hope that no one feels threatened by that, because I think it has to provide multiple opportunities within that governance model. But the other aspect of this is that I am very cognizant of the fact that I am not the chair of either of the education committees. Representative Gelser is the chair of one of those committees. I take a lot of guidance from her in what she believes she can address during a short February session, and what she believes is basically trying to take on a little bit more than can be dealt with in that session. And I think both sides, all sides, I don't think there are both sides, I think there are maybe 4 sides, 6 sides, 7 sides, should just work together to try to get some resolution on some of these issues in February, knowing that we ultimately are not going to have all the answers by February on virtual education. I think that this task force has been a testament to that. I had, too, hoped that we would have more time, but given our budget situation in the state, we've only been allotted a few number of meetings, and we actually had to plead to get our meeting on November 30th.
Plead is a good word.
Plead. Big. And all of our regular standing committees are in the same situation, where they would normally be meeting more often than they are meeting, and now they're meeting less. Our caucus offices, both on both sides of the aisle, are operating with less resources. I used to have 2 analysts for all of state government. Now I'm holding one of the positions open because someone left, mm-hmm, to save money so I can meet the budget projections that we have. But I have 1 analyst now to do all of state government within the caucus office, and my colleagues upstairs on the Senate side are facing similar challenges given what our budget picture is. But I do think these have been worthwhile discussions, and we've put a lot of things on the record. And I think when you see the report, I think you'll be pleased by the report. Rep. Gelser, Chair.
It did occur to me. There were two things that I did want to put on the record, okay. Speaking of the record. I wanted to clarify again for all of those families that took the time to write letters and those that didn't, that might be listening or might be worrying, to clarify and reemphasize that there is nothing in this bill that puts at risk school operating next year or the year after. And I just hope that, I know that that takes a lot of stress, it takes a lot of energy for families worrying about the existence of their schools, but it is not in this concept and certainly not the intent to close these schools. The second piece I wanted to put on the record, I'd forgotten that I had made the note about, on the last page, page 9, in that section C, in terms of looking at how virtual public charter schools serve children with disabilities, I think it would be really interesting and helpful when the committee does that to look at, we've heard particularly around some kids with autism, some success stories of kids making progress in their academic work through these things. And I think if we could pull some of that back in, I know some of us are working in other realms on how do we improve access to academics and academic achievement for students with disabilities. It'd be great to use this opportunity to capture some of that information as well.
Anything additional for the good of our labors? Yes,
I hadn't thought about. Thank you. I hadn't thought about something until Mark brought it up, and I think it's very important for us to look at back again to the CAPS part and make sure that we're not penalizing some people on the K-8 models to somehow ensure that those students will have a home somewhere if they choose one that's already capped out. I mean, where are those students going to be orphaned or forced back into a situation they don't want to be in? And I hadn't thought about that, so I just wanted to throw that up again.
I also just wanted to add that as we look at doing our report out of this committee, I think we do need to acknowledge the fact that the Department of Education has such incredibly limited resources, and that if we truly want to have this work happen, we need to figure out how to provide them the resources to do the work, because it doesn't help any of us for this to be in limbo year after year after year.
They have Ms. Hunt. What more do they need? For those of you that don't know, Ms. Hunt was our longtime legislative counsel on education issues. And so, well, with that, anything additional, Madam Chair? For sure.